1995 San Francisco Museum presents session number 313, Obedience, a Principle of the Gospel or the Law from Hell, by Scott Fisher.
The Gospel or the Law from Hell, and he's a social psychologist, and I don't want to take up any more of his time because it sounds very good.
That was quickie. But I did get warned that since there are more people here than in the sex workshop, we've got to cover both. Promises without fulfillment. My game plan is to spend 30 minutes drumming through in a pretty aggressive way the thoughts that come along in this subject, and then stop no matter where I am so that we can have plenty of time to talk about it. But I do want to pump out a lot of stuff, and that's probably the fastest way to do it. Try not to get bored if I'm looking down reading. I'll try to read quickly, and please make note of your questions and whatever, so we can, you know, be sure to hit this. You can tell from the get-go where I'm going, right? Obedience in the way we present this notion as a principle, where we are supposed to do something because somebody says so, is indeed the law from hell. And we need to look at some of the information that we have available that makes that intelligible and fills out our inner response that we know is correct. So that's what I'm going to try to do. And I think there are some implications in the way the church runs itself, the way we run the church as membership, and the way the leadership runs the church as leadership. And I don't want to miss the opportunity to say what this is saying to me. So, as Mormons, we believe that all blessings are predicated on obedience to the law in which the blessing is predicated. And in this, the Mormon context, obedience is not really a law at all, or even a principle. It's what we do when we observe or keep a law. You know, obey means do it, you know. As used in the church today, however, obedience has become a synonym for coercion, and is actually a violation of gospel law. The promise with a blessing, if you do what's right, you'll be blessed, is exchanged for the threat, do what I say or else. No. And examples abound. It's suggested in this paper that the dominance of obedience culture in the church is a function of management practices of control. These control practices are coupled with dependency in a culture that has been fostered by members who are dependent, by promising next life rewards to the faithful, by advancing up the organizational ladder those who are compliant, and by selecting out those who compete intentionally or unintentionally with the dominant church leadership that values an image favorable to the non-Mormon public and doctrinal purity, and that they value that over temporal and eternal happiness, integrity, love, support, and joy. Okay? Heavy. From Emily Dickinson. Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye. Much sense, the starkest madness. 'Tis the majority in this, as all prevail. Assent, and you are sane. Demure, you're straightway dangerous, and handled with a chain. One more time. Much madness is divinest sense to a discerning eye, much sense the starkest madness. 'Tis the majority, in this as all prevail. Assent and you are demure, you're straightway dangerous, and handled with a chain. Okay. Everybody's got the problem. Monasteries have the problem. I go to the Tibetan Buddhists, and someone had asked Rinpoche the question, is it okay to say no to your guru? It took him a week to think about it. And he came up with the right answer. Of course it's okay. Huh? In the selection of the Dalai Lama that lives up here in Bountiful, he's 6 years old, the next Dalai Lama. And he's right in our town. And the question on the interviewer on the radio was, well, what if he doesn't accept it? Huh? Look what we do to boys at age 12. You got to go to priesthood meeting? Is there any free agency for a 12-year-old in going to priesthood meeting? This is discussed. Now, for the spiritual leader of Tibet. At age six, the mother in charge of the care of this child, this incarnate Lama, answers, well, of course, it's his choice. Of course, it's his choice. So some cultures manage to cope with this maybe better than others, but the obedience issue is prevalent in all systems, so let's not feel like we're the only ones with the problem. So, my purpose, I want to show that the way of obedience is harmful and counterproductive to the goals of the church, both to help people to grow and to present an image of the church that will be attractive to the non-crazy population worldwide, that there are some positive management alternatives that are more likely to achieve both objectives, and obedience is being practiced, as it's being practiced, is truly the law from hell, and what is needed is synonymous with good Mormonism. When you stop to think about it, it's really a no-brainer. Okay, so we're doing a lot of bristling. And why are we doing all that bristling? I think we're bristling because there's a lot of violation around us, and we're in pain. I want to look at the problem first in the context of human growth and development, and like to consider the problem from the standpoint of management practices. Coercion doesn't happen in a vacuum. There's a coercer and a coercee. The coercees in the church are part of the problem because there are so many that take peace in being told what to do to feel okay and on the right track. There is a worship of certainty instead of a worship of faith. We call it I know, and if you can't say I know, you're in big trouble. Think about that. When is faith extolled? As faith, as opposed to certainty. And certainty is the hobgoblin of a lot of little minds adored by a lot of petty statesmen and divines, to sneak in on Emerson's well-known statement. And it ain't meant for the human condition. And those who are being persecuted for destroying faith are not destroying faith at all, but are building faith. They're destroying certainty by raising questions. And a major source of the problem, I believe, is that many, if not most, of the general authorities themselves are being challenged in their faith, that they are living under expectations of being able to present with certainty certain ideas. And this because of the dependent population that rises up and says, give us a king and save us and give us certainty. And if you don't, we'll get other leaders. And so these poor guys, if they'll forgive that jocularity, have to respond by going beyond what they really can do. I experienced this as a bishop. I sat there and a beautiful young man, intelligent medical student, said, look, there ought to be room in this church for belief. And I said, yes, yes. This is after I'd been released as a bishop. Yeah, I said, that's been my gift. In section 46, it says, many gifts. To some it is given to believe. That has been my gift, to believe. I've never been able to say I know about a lot of things. It's been my gift to believe. After which, a former stake president came up to me and said, Scott, you can do better than that. You should do better than that. You've been a bishop. You got it? Now, what do you do with that? I smarted for months. I'm still smarting. What a put down. Demeaned my belief? Huh? What do we do to each other? Okay? So, let's give the general authorities a break. And if T. Edgar Lyon is right, now I can quote him because he's dead and they can't hurt him. This man I love as much as I love any teacher I've ever had. And Ed Lyon used to wring his hands and say, the problem with the general authorities is they don't read. They read each other, they read their own stuff, and they read the scriptures and they put their own wrinkle on it. And then they go out. You know? And where are they? They're not here. No? Do they read anything here? Well, they don't have to read Sunstone. But what comes through the newspaper, the references, don't go a heck of a lot deeper than the Chicago Tribune. Now, come on. I'm off my pace here. but I think I've done a pretty good job of laying out the problem of the contradiction and the pressure of the membership that wants certainty and has strong needs to be cared for. The Mormon Church has a very tight belief system that supports these tendencies. The belief in a prophet of God speaks to and who will ever and who will never let him go astray. Okay, the prophet's supposed to do this. Speaks to God and he'll never let him go astray. It's a pretty comforting belief. And there's a top rung in the celestial kingdom that everyone can get to if they conform or repent. The belief system works like a bubble, however. As long as no one breaks it with something that doesn't work, the bubble holds together and it works like a cocoon, and everyone inside feels safe. And trust in the leaders is a big part of this cocoon. And trust is built on everything they say and being and knowing and having all the right answers. And so we have a lot of pressures operating from a part of the population that wag the dog. So working through issues is part of growing up. The obvious implication if we value growth is for leaders to help people through the process. We should be supporting people and leaders through the process. We're in a church that has the mission to do these things. Save the dead, perfect the living, and convert everyone else. And this is still the threefold mission of the church. And as long as this is the mission, then mutual support and personal growth and joy and happiness and integrity might be taking back seats. I wonder if there is room in the church to incorporate growth as part of the perfection notion. Since we're going to be stuck with this misinterpretation of Scripture, it had nothing to do with learning how to obey all of the principles. Any gospel scholar, Bible scholar will tell you that, and any thoughtful person will recognize that, I think, with a little bit of work. Look, Jesus was bad-mouthing the Pharisees. The Pharisees were the ones that had 150,000 rules for everything, and he was saying, that ain't the way, don't be like them. And what have we done? We've done exactly the same thing. We've twisted it around. Perfection is to be able to do the 143 things that some friends of mine created the list, that's what Mormons are expected to do. It's 143 things on the list by the time you get the food storage and tithing and so on. It's all there. And is that the way to perfection, is to do all 143 of them? Can we incorporate growth as part of that? And is there room in there someplace for joy and happiness? That's same spirit that possesses our bodies, possesses ourselves as we die, is that spirit that will be with us in the eternal world if we believe Alma in the Book of Mormon. Well, how about getting people ready to be happy in the next world? You practice happiness, you get happiness, you stay happy. Where do you hear that? The purpose of life is joy? Adam and Eve felt they might have joy? Well, when did you last hear that in a sacrament meeting sermon? You know? Come on! Now, can we work that into perfection? As if we're going to make perfection the goal, can we put a spin on it that works and is comprehensive and really includes the things that make sense to us? Okay. Now, I think if the brethren would read a little more, they'd get more into that. I wish they'd read Elaine Pagel's On the Origin of Satan and kick in some really good stuff there. There's some really nifty, very readable summaries of scholarship. And you can tell in your heart whether a person's talking truth or not. Come on, brethren. You know, read the stuff and you'll decide whether it's a lot of baloney or whether it's good, but read it. You know, and not just to defend. We get put-downs on some of the work of scholarship, but we don't get the recognition of the values that are there. And I think that would really help us, and we'd be moving away from obedience and domination that people fall into when they don't have information. And information is the key to about everything. Well, now, I think, so let's switch to some social psychological material. I think I've been drumming on this point of, hey, I haven't hit it well enough. Look, people grow up as infants and they need to be attached to a parent. And they go through several periods of breakaway adolescent, 2-year-old, 4-year-old, you know, 16-year-old. Kids ought to be pretty well adult by the time they're 17, 18. We've really lost our influence by that time. Parenthood is to give them what they need when they need it. I have a good friend, psychologist. He's watching his 7-year-old out there pushing the lawnmower around the lawn. And he's just so proud of this kid, you know. And as the kid comes by with the lawnmower, he goes over to him and he puts his arm around him and he says, hey, Chris, you know, good job. And kid just sort of brushes him off and goes on. Dad says, hey, Chris, you know, I was trying to give you a hug. Did you not want a hug? And kid turns to his father and says, only when I need it. Boom. Huh? So, how about a little attachment, a little benevolence, a little nurturance when we need it? By the time we get to be 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, pushing toward 120, how much do you need of this mollycoddling of leadership? And how much room can there be for our growth becomes the issue. And so I want to say dependency is a developmental issue, and I hope the church will take the posture of helping us in a developmental way, recognizing where we need it, and that we want to go on from that. We do a great job of quoting Adam, who said, I don't know to these messengers. I don't know why I'm doing this. I'm waiting for further light and knowledge. I'm waiting to find out. Oh, I've lost the quote. Tell me somebody. What? Save God commanded or something like that. I'm doing what I'm told. Okay? And we quote that a lot. Well, that was his first year of life in this either history or metaphor, wherever you're at. Now, why don't we quote the other passage? And Adam was full of years and full of wisdom and gathered his whole family around him. Huh? With a picture of maturity, this picture of wisdom, of having something, learned something, of having something to give. And where is the respect for gray hair in the church if you don't belong to the Quorum of 12? Okay? Well, let's have some. Okay. Now, obedience is a bad habit. It is a bad habit to expect it, and it's a bad habit to do it. And any time we get in a habit, we are going to be stuck. And we better recognize that. As you're talking about psychoneurological kind of things, you got associational pathways that get built around these 10 million neurons and 200,000 apiece dendrites, and we feel uncomfortable if we're not in the same pattern. Now, discomfort doesn't necessarily mean Satan's got us. Huh? It means we're uncomfortable. Fold your arms, everybody. Would you please fold your arms? Just do it. Yeah, do it. Okay, now see which hand's on top. Okay? Now reverse it and put the other hand on top. Carefully. I can't even do it. Now, how does that feel? Comfortable? Now, this is a great moral dilemma. This is a great moral problem for you. You've just changed to fold your hands the wrong way, and you feel uncomfortable with it. That ought to be enough to point out that it is not a moral issue when you feel uncomfortable with something. What was this for? You got a brain. Think, you know. Sure, use your inspiration. Sure. But let's stop worshiping comfort and certainty, you know. And let's have some of this coming out. Hey, look, growth requires discomfort. Breaking of habits requires discomfort, whether it's a good habit or a bad habit. Breaking the habit requires the endurance of discomfort. Preparation. Help people deal with comfort. Now, I got to push through some work by Stanley Milgram. We got to get the social psychological part of this obedience thing. And in Milgram's work, that's really well known, but briefly summarized, is that he engaged subjects for experiments on a ruse of helping with a memory experiment, and those he worked with were told to administer an electric shock when the, quote, learner was really a participant in the study. He was a compatriot. And when he failed to get it right, and using a level of voltage that was to range from 15 volts to 450 volts. At various points, as voltage increased, the actor would scream and even pound on the door or table to indicate his pain. When the subject registered reluctance to go on, the experimenter merely said, the experiment must go on. With these parameters, 65% of the people, and this is a random sample from Hartford, Connecticut, good cross-sectional data sampler. This is good research, okay? 65% of the people administered what they thought was the maximum of 450 volts. 65%. Okay? And, for us feminists, no difference for men and women. See, we can't save the world and save the church by making women in charge of everything. Okay? We're going to have to forget that notion. We're all in this soup together. We have the same kind of problems. Okay? When the subjects were one step away, that is, when they only passed along an order, and someone else pulled the switch, 90% went the limit of 450 volts. Uh-huh. The results were identical for men and women. Now, anyone who wishes to examine the study more carefully, read the book Obedience to Authority by Stan Milgram. The question was, and continues to be, how is it that normal people, drawn from an average sample of the population, when put in a situation where they're under the direction of someone in authority, would carry out an order that they believe might kill another human being? That this phenomenon happens in real life needs no further explanation. There are ample examples in the murders of 6 million Jews, millions more in communist China, and Jim Jones and David Koresh, and given current Mormon beliefs, it is not out of line to refer to the recent excommunications as killings. The victims have been killed to the organization and to their next live growth, stopped forever, according to the beliefs of these leaders doing the killing. This is serious stuff. It is precise parallel to the problems that we have seen, and I don't want it pushed under the rug, and I'm going to do everything I can to keep it from getting under a rug. This is bad stuff. It is obedience cult behavior. And we are getting a rep for a cult of obedience when you start talking to people around the circle. I mean, those nifty little television ads can only do so much. Okay, now Milgram draws some conclusions. I have to say that because the public image of the church is the predominant value for at least half the general authorities, and for a certain number, they don't give a darn. They do whatever they think is right, okay? And then we have to talk about what's right. Okay. Now, Milgram draws some conclusions that have relevance to us in the church. And I want to touch briefly on them, which is darned all I can do. When the victim was brought closer, it cut the abuse in half. Okay? We can wonder if the leaders ordering the excommunications knew the victims personally and spent time with them, if the effect might be different half of the time. Okay? The distance makes killing easier. Eichmann was sickened by what he saw in the photos. Truman never got over his decision to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Mormonism has no place for the higher-ups to give orders to excommunicate members. The authority is vested solely in the local leaders. So it's counter-church procedure when this rule is violated. And it is violated. Okay. If the general authority stopped or stepped out of it and there was no surveillance, with general authority sanction by this so-called committee to strengthen the members, then this would be dramatically different. There wouldn't be any problem without that stupid committee to so-called strengthen the members. It's a surveillance technique. And it's an insult to everybody. You know? It's not needed. And it's exquisitely damaging. Now, my stake president told me that, thanks to this nifty little article on the benefits of ordaining women to the priesthood, that for 1 year, 2 weeks did not go by that he did not receive a phone call from Salt Lake City about me. Now, he didn't tell me exactly what the words were. What are the words? Have you excommunicated him yet? No. How's he doing? Oh, we'd like to know. Out of all of the members of the greater Michigan area, they singled me out to find out how I was doing, to strengthen me. You know, it's goodness of their heart. You know. Huh? Now, the stake president happened to have a lot of courage, and in his own ways, not a very sensitive man, or wasn't, but he was able to make his own decisions. Okay. But what's the message to a lot of stake presidents? Would they be in the 65%? You know, I'm getting a message, I think. You know, is that what happened to David Wright? It's certainly what happened to Michael Barrett. Now, Michael Barrett was told, and Michael told me. This is the guy that wrote the editorials in the Boston newspapers. And he said, his stake president told him, look, you were excommunicated not because anything you said was wrong. You were excommunicated for disobedience. Word for freaking word. Bam, right there. Now, we all know that's true with Janice Allred. We know it's true with Levina. We know it's true with all of these people, but it's a little bit more by innuendo and supposition. But there you got it right flat on the surface. Okay? Now, that's what's going on. This is an obedience issue for those who are exercising it. They refused to stop publishing whatever it was that somebody thought was not good to publish, and so they were thrown out. Now, that's the law from hell we're talking about. That's the application of the law from hell. Okay? Nothing good about that. Now, I'm lost. Okay, I think we got to where the victim was brought closer, it cut the abuse in half. Okay, that was one. Now, number two. When the roles were reversed in Milgram's study so that it was the learner that demanded to be shocked when he got it wrong. Huh? Not one subject was willing to administer a shock. Interesting. Subjects were willing to shock the learner on the authority's demand, but not on the learner's demand. They regarded the learner as having less rights over himself than the authority had over him. That's what we've developed in the culture of authority over I don't know how many thousands of years. I said this problem is not just a Mormon church problem, it's a cultural problem. And maybe this helps us understand, if you've ever wondered why home teachers and leaders don't care about what you think. What you think you need. Brother, this is what I think I need. What happens to their ears? And what happens to the face? We got the message. We're told what we're supposed to do to you in this control system. But this is what I need, brother so-and-so. My brother was living off of courage and personal strength and 4 hours of sleep for several years while he tried to dig himself out of an enormous hole in the ground. And he was using tea to stay awake while he drove 4 hours from one building site to another as he was trying to do this. And he had to get a temple recommend to get into his kid's wedding. And so he went through the process and was told that he had to quit drinking tea and that he should substitute tea with no dose. To which he replied, "But no dose makes me sick. There's 4 times as much caffeine in the no dose pill than there is in a cup of tea. And it makes me sick." Doesn't matter. And then it went on. The counselor in the state presidency phoned him every month to see if he was keeping up to his commitments. I mean, they had him over the barrel, right? He agreed to whatever he had to agree to get in the temple. And then about a month later, he called him back and said, "Look, this is what I will do. I will not use my temple recommend. So you can be assured I will not be doing that. But don't you ever call me again about this insulting, dominating attitude that you have. That is also a very stupid one." So he played it honestly. But look what's going on. Look at the function of the obedience in this and the arm twisting of getting into the temple to see your kid married in this kind of a stupid way. Okay? So it functions. Okay. So we need to listen to people, maybe. Maybe people can contribute to the solutions about what they need. We're going to hit that later. Oh, we're done. Orders originating outside of the perceived authority lose all force. When are we really out of here? We really have a half an hour left? Okay, I'm going to push fast. Orders originated outside of the perceived authority lose all force. It's only in the system that it matters. When two authorities are in a disagreement, everything stops. This was one wonderful thing. Look at this. When two authorities are in disagreement, no one pulled the switch. No one. Now, one of them pulled it once from 15 to 20 degree volts, something like that. But out of all of the subjects, nobody did it. Do you see what that means? You've got one general authority making a decision, passing down the word, and it's abusive and dangerous to somebody. If nobody of the general authority levels speaks up as another alternative authority and says, "Hey, that's not good. We shouldn't do that." Okay? Then it will have this power. 90%. 90% will pull, will kill them. 450 volts because they're one step away. See? But enter one person, one other authority that says, "No, we won't do that." And it stops it dead. What are the implications for that? It's pretty obvious. Are the general authorities going to stay together forever on everything that is wrong? Or is somebody going to have the courage and the sense to break ranks? See, I think they got the courage, but I don't think they've got the right rationale. They think that staying together is strength. Staying together is weakness. What have you got? You got the dumbest, you got the weakest link in the chain is running the whole church because nobody will disagree with him. You get the aberrant, and in Milgram's word, the malevolent leader dominating because nobody will take him on because they believe that unity is important and it's important to the public face and all these dependent people will fall away. Huh? But is that really what happens in the church? It is not what happens. There was a meeting of mission presidents in the tabernacle, and Henry D. Moyle was running the baseball era, and he's up there driving these guys to set quotas. And one of the mission presidents, newly called mission presidents, called him on the spot and said, "Brother Moyle, are you saying that there are quotas?" And Joseph Fielding Smith got up and said, "There are no quotas in the kingdom of God." Boom. And that silliness stopped, at least at that level. Boom. And what happened to those mission presidents? They all left the church, you know? They all left happy. There was sense. Here, they left the meeting happy, you know? Now, you can example after example. Look at the evolution problem. Joseph Fielding Smith writes this crazy book about evolution, and I liked it. At 20 years old, that was a wonderful book. I've learned a little since then. And now I would answer it like President McKay answered. Somebody went to David McKay and says, what do you think of Joseph Fielding Smith's book on evolution? He said, "My friend Joseph Fielding Smith is entitled to his opinion." He said both things. He said, "Don't you knock my friend. He's entitled to write the book, but it's his opinion." Okay? Nobody went away because of that. The Catholic Church now has 35 dissident groups auguring for the ordination of women and a married clergy. They're public. They have bishops involved in these dissident groups. They're very vocal. Ain't nobody getting thrown out. And a lot of people are staying in the Catholic Church that wouldn't be in the Catholic Church. It's strengthening the Catholic Church. Dissidence does not damage, does not destroy. The leadership is wrong in their expectation that there will be damage because they disagree that the membership can't handle it. Now, some people may have difficulty handling it. Their purpose, to hold these people in their little infant states of mommy and daddy are always in agreement all their lives. They're going to find out that mommy and daddy have different opinions and that they can grow. So this is a choice thing, and I think it's a complicated problem, and I don't want to oversimplify, and I don't want to ridicule anybody, but I'm sure ridiculing the stupidity of remaining in a falsified unity when people are being injured, and the injury would stop immediately if one person would break ranks and say it. Now, they could talk about this. Let's have some openness. Let's have openness in the way we give our talks. Huh? We could go back to Orson Pratt disagreeing with Brigham Young. Not very many people disagreed with Brigham, but he disagreed with a lot of people. Okay, if you want, let him take on everybody but the prophet, if that's so important to you. Okay, but let's have disagreement with everybody. If the prophet can't handle it, then don't take him on. But take on everybody else. Okay, so orders. We've done that one. Milgram found that the revolt against the malevolent authority is most effectively brought about by collective rather than individual action. Good point. When two peers defied the authority, only 10% instead of the 65% applied the 450 volts. One partner. Coming together. Disagreeing. You sit down there and you say, and your peers disagree with you. Peers change the opinion of the authorities. When some of us got ticked off at the excommunications and the committee to strengthen the members, and 45 people signed a letter and sent it to the first presidency, it was a wonderfully written letter. It was so gentle, and it couldn't ruffle anybody. But it ruffled. Why? Because there were 45 signatures on a letter. That's why it ruffled. Now, what are you going to do? Okay? Unless I forget this story. When Thoreau was in jail because he wouldn't pay his taxes, Emerson paid his taxes, but before he paid him, he came around the side of the jail and says, "Henry, what are you doing in there?" And Thoreau says, "What are you doing out there?" I hope you get the point. Somebody once said, these courageous early American leaders will all hang separately if we don't hang together. I got it backwards, but hang together or we'll all hang separately. Huh? How many people are willing to kill? This is fun for us. This is fun for me. It's fun for me to examine myself. In the process of breaking with authority, there are steps to go through. There is doubt followed by dissent that leads eventually to defiance of authority. And there is a buildup of tension along the way, like pressure on the nose cone of an airplane going through the sound barrier, until the moment of defying authority and you say, I won't do that. And then the anxiety goes away. You break through. Now, that's what I'm saying to you guys. You want to respond to your conscience? It ain't going to be comfortable. You got a habit to break? It ain't going to be comfortable. If you hang in there with your integrity, with what you believe, and endure through the pressure, then you'll come to the point where you break through and you defy what you consider to be malevolent, and then peace comes. This is the story of everyone I know who has left the Mormon Church. They get that moment, the peace comes, because they did, for them, the right thing. And we've got to talk about whether that's is that the only option? And it may be. Okay. Now, the last thing I got to talk about from Milgram is he identifies what he calls a shift in agency. The person entering an authority system no longer views himself or herself as acting out of his or her own purposes, but rather comes to see himself, herself, as an agent for executing the wishes of another person. And Milgram points out that once a person conceives his action in this light, profound alterations occur in his behavior and internal functioning, so pronounced that the altered attitude places the person in a different state from the one he was in prior to the integration into the hierarchy. As an agent, the person sees himself as carrying out another person's wishes instead of being autonomous, acting on his own. So, we might say that the obedient one who becomes an agent in the hierarchy is a person who has gained the whole world for the organization but has lost his or her own soul. Milgram points out that it is an element of free choice that determines whether the person defines himself in or out, that there are some critical releasers involved, and we just don't have time to deal with all of it. But imagine that. Have you ever experienced that where you gave up your agency for the authority? I have. I think it's part of normal growth and development in an authority system that we would all experience that. When was the last time you did it? How did it feel? You have this moment of euphoria. I am so glad I am supporting, sustaining this leader. Oh, this is so wonderful. You have that feeling. This is a good thing. At least I did. You get that at first. And then later you go, oh, what have I done? Or, you know, and you struggle with these second thoughts. There's some struggling that can go on. This agent shift is fundamental to doing bad things for people. Now, I've got a few things. Here's a good story of a good thing, an exception. A new state president. A few weeks ago, wanted to address home teaching and the possibility of a 90% goal. He turned to ask his newly appointed counselor if that seemed like a good idea in front of several hundred men, to which the counselor replied he thought it would be coercive to do that, to which the stake president replied, then we won't do it. Ba-boom, ba-boom. Okay? Now, I've got to do this one. In the Buddhist history of the Buddha, he experienced also three temptations from the force of evil, known as Mara. The third temptation of Mara is in the form of a question to the Buddha. He asked, do you give alms? This is the evil one asking the Buddha, do you give alms? What's wrong with that? That seems so harmless, doesn't it? Do you give alms? The temptation is insidious because the respondent loses either way he answers. She answers. The answer acknowledges the right of the questioner to pass judgment, that the self-image is dependent on the approvable, favorable, or favorable judgment of the questioner, who in this case is a representation of evil. How very insightful, and how very indicative of the major problem and evil of the temple recommend interview process. Have you ever felt coercion in that experience? Have you ever not? Have you ever felt that you gave up some of your soul, that you let your agency kind of go in that experience? Every time a person goes for an interview, he or she gives up a piece of his soul. It feels so good at one level to be told you're okay, approved of God and his appointed servants. Such a powerful vehicle for establishing authority, but such an insidious one so far as the development of the soul is concerned. We formally give over the right to another human being to determine our worthiness as persons. How demeaning. I think we know, subliminally, that there is something wrong with this practice, and we do it because the rewards are greater in our dependent state, and the alternative is so anxiety-producing that we continue it. I'm aware of a state president who wanted to recommend and had to get the bishop's signature, and the bishop had the temerity to ask the state president the questions. It annoyed the state president very much to be asked the questions. Was it because the questioner was an underling that it annoyed him? Or because he knew at one level that it was an invasion of his life and privacy that anyone would ask the questions? I hope that I'm being very clear, that I think the temple interview process is damaging to people at a fundamental level. The more so, the more they like it. You want to confess? You want the intimate interaction and discussion of problem solving with a mentor or a helper? Then get those experiences for their own right. The leader will be available. No need to use the interview. And then there are those instances of voyeurism and sexual abuse that young and even older women get involved in occasionally, as long as we don't have any women in the leadership positions talking to the women. The temple interview is a perfect way to establish a link with authority and a damaging experience under any circumstance. Okay. Now I think I better conclude. And I want to do that. And I hope I can remember to pull that in. I wonder if the church leadership would like to consider growth and development toward becoming autonomous, godlike beings, as part of its concept of perfection. Is perfection, as it is viewed in the threefold mission, merely performing the 143 tasks, or can it be put on the list? Second, can we as a church rejoice in people's creative endeavor as a way of celebrating their gifts and supporting their development of their gifts, when the only legitimate church activity is what passes through priesthood correlation? We don't do that. We had a supplemental hymn book in our ward. We had creche displays that did wonderful things. We have a Sunday school class of scripture study that we created. Every program in the church that is significant today was started because somebody at some grassroots level started it. Every program. No programs that are used in the church to help people were invented at the top. Why can't we legitimize this function? If we take a supportive approach to the problem becomes how to help. And we listen to the learner. We try to facilitate. We focus on sharing information. And we focus on relationships. It's pretty obvious to me that the key to increasing retention in the church is improving and expanding relationships. There is such a thing as gathering groups. Groups are gatherings, little groups of people that come together and meet together. In a ward I know about, they have this huge creche display that lasts 10 days, and thousands of people in the community come and go through it, and so it's good for missionary work, they think, so they do it. But you can't hold church on Sunday one day because you've got 2,000 creche displays, creches sitting in there, and it's a huge job to move that in and out. And you've got thousands of people going through, so they leave it. But that means that Sunday they split up into small groups and have sacrament meetings in homes, 3, 4, and 5 families. Ever hear of something like that? You know, that's the way it started out, didn't it? Huh? You know, and the people keep coming to the bishop with their opinions about this. And it's such a spiritual experience. They say, why can't we do this more often? So when the stake president went to the bishop and said, look, what can we do to our meeting houses to make them more conducive? Brilliant man, full of integrity and courage and love. He never conducts a meeting that he doesn't tear up. Said to the stake president, bring in a TD6 and bulldoze it down. There are many voices not being listened to that are asking for help in addressing how we handle abuse of authority, and that there be a workable solution And to date, the leadership is a withholding parent or something else. Maybe a frightened, insecure parent who doesn't know how to deal with an adolescent or adult child. Let everyone speak and everyone listen, that all may be edified of all. It speaks of peer descent. It speaks of leadership descent. That was the only instruction I'm aware of in the scripture as to how we should handle our teaching experience. Let everyone speak. Let everyone listen, that all may be edified of all. That's still a pretty good idea. And so let's be promoting that and then doing some other things. The willingness of the leadership to listen and respond with integrity and support to those who they ask to sustain them, and be as loyal, faithful, and trusting to them as the leaders want for themselves, is going to determine if the church carries its adult people with it into the next century. It may be that the leadership can't do this, and that the church can't do this. Then it can help people graduate and go into gatherings or churches who want them. We damage or destroy families by persecuting the part of the family that's intellectual or feminist or homosexual. If we can't be adult enough to help all of our people, then let's help our people graduate. And why not? So maybe the church should have a celebration or graduation service for those who are ready to go on. And I don't mean to death. I would like to be the bishop of an inactive ward. Jesus said, "The whole don't need a physician." I used to believe that. Don't think so anymore. I think he was talking about organized religion. I think we should reconsider the temple recommend interviews as control mechanisms, a coaching model for the first time going through the temple, an opportunity to explore concerns if you have something in your life that's a problem, keeping the person in charge. Either the leadership should have serious, effective consensus decisions in their councils, or they should learn to disagree in public. I do not believe that the excommunications represent consensus of the leadership, but some inability on their part to manage the differences among themselves. They are, however, unable to control the damage being done by a few of the... and the church is being made to look like an obedience cult to the outside observer. Protestations of love and openness for all are appearing ridiculous. Hinckley's statement followed by the all-red excommunication. You know, unless you see this as an obvious split in the leadership and a power struggle, it's horrible for Brother Hinckley to make that. And I believe Brother Hinckley was sincere in what he said. An equally effective way to inhibit malevolent authority is for public disagreement among the leaders. When two disagree, no one will follow, and it would strengthen the church rather than weaken it. This way, the way it is, one leads the way. The fallacy of unity is not even good for images. It's why Joseph Smith got killed. He was too much power centered in one person. Fifth, the leadership needs to be more egalitarian if it wants people to treat each other as equals and wants people to retain their agency. The current practice of succession is in the presidency is probably the number one contributor to the problem. The principle of hierarchy has been forced into a situation designed to be one of equality. An apostle is an apostle. Succession by seniority is the culprit. All of the 12 and the first presidency are prophets, seers, and revelators. It would promote equality magnificently in the church, everywhere, if they would rotate the presidency among themselves. We rotate everybody everywhere. Bishops rotate, state presidents rotate, not often enough. They ought to cut it back to 5 years. What's this 10-year, 7-year business? Even general authorities rotate in one of the quorums. Now, that's a good idea. You know where I got this idea? I got this out of an Aborigine culture in Australia. Read Mutant Messages. This is the way they do it. Everybody's got gifts, and you bring them forward at different times. And if one person in the 12 wants to be the president so bad, let him do it. That's wonderful. You know? Give him a couple of months. You know? Why be a year? Why be 10 years? Maybe the man is very old and very weak, but maybe he wants the experience of leadership, and maybe he's got it for a few months. When Joseph Fielding Smith at 96 was made president of the church, he walked around town like a teenager. I don't know for how many weeks, but he was observed with his bounce in his step. It's wonderful. How do you put all that together? I don't know, but 15 people can sit down and figure that out and still rotate the job. I know a group that took themselves away on a retreat. The eight owners of a company of only 400 people. But these eight guys went away and they decided who was going to be the next president of the company. Okay? They knew what the company needed. They knew what they needed individually. If we value growth and development of everybody, we'll value the growth and development of the apostles as well. You know? And preferences. There's a way to work all that out and to talk about it. If you'll break down this and have a rotating system, I think it's a great idea. It would not take a revelation to do it, because they're all prophets and revelators anyway. Enough of that. So get away from the corporate model. We got to do that. You know, this is crazy, IBM. And if we're not going to get away from the IBM model, then we're going to have to start acting like IBM and give some respect to some of the things that corporate management respects. Retention. 10% of the people that are baptized in the Detroit area come to church a year later. What is it in your area? I don't know. It never gets over 50%. The average is probably around 20%. Count that a quality measure. And what do you got? We got a lousy run organization. As a corporation, this place stinks. It doesn't run well. You know? So let's face it, it's not a corporation. I mean, Edwards at BYU told in his report on the welfare system, he recommended immediately disbanding it. Okay? As a BYU economics professor, and he got fired. That it was a bad deal as a business. Okay? Well, they decided in that instance that, well, we're not going to run this like a corporation. Okay? Well, maybe there are a lot of ways we should decide that this is not a corporation. We have terrible sacrament meetings, and Brother Hunter said this to me when I could get in to see him, because I'm an old Pasadena State guy, and we had a relationship over the years and so on, so don't think I have this great privileged relationship with the prophet. But 2 years ago, I had two two-hour meetings there. And I said, look, here's a problem with sacrament meetings, and I know how to fix it. And he was very interested. I said, I think they're getting worse. He says, I think they're getting worse too. Huh? Now, my stake of president thought that the reason I had a bad attitude towards sacrament meetings is because I haven't been going to the temple enough. But I don't know if that was President Brother Henner's Hunter's problem, you know. He wasn't going to the temple often enough. You know, he's like, something wrong with sacrament meetings. Well, anyway, obviously this is tongue-in-cheek. I don't think we ought to try to run this thing like an organization. I think you've been wonderful. Now what we're doing, wasting our time talking about things like this, agonizing ourselves with the miseries, actually it's very serious stuff and we should be doing it, and that's fine. But let's look around for the things that bring joy and happiness in our life, because that's really where it's at. And I hope that you'll consider these ideas in this context and weigh it against your experience and keep what makes any sense to you and forget the rest. And thanks. Oh, one thing. Help. Okay, I don't know how much time we got for questions, but do it.
What rules would you have?
I didn't understand the question.
What rules would you have in church? Let's say a temple recommend. Anybody can go there from not really tithing,
massive. So you're asking what is
the temple recommend.
So what's the temple recommend list of criteria?
Yeah,
well, there are 10.
No, what would you have?
What would I have?
Yeah,
anybody? Sure, you go to the bishop. I think you ought to be a member of the church. And so I think, you know, the bishop knows whether you're a member or not. You know, I think you ought to go to the bishop and say, will you please give me a temple recommend? And he'll sign it.
Why?
Well,
I can pay tithing, I can do anything. I can be whatever.
I think it's up to you to decide that. I think child molesters go to the temple. See, one person in the group would not allow a child molester to go to the temple. If he knew he was a child molester, he wouldn't let him go. What do the rest of you think? Oh, go ahead. Oh, it's a change of subject. Anybody else want to shoot out on this business of temple recommend? Pardon? They can go to church. Are you saying? I know. What? So your point is that a child molester can still go to church, so he doesn't have to go to the temple, and that ought to be fine. What's the point, Keel?
My guess is that if a child molester wanted to go to the temple, he could very well go to the interview and lie, or he or she. He just, you know, lie at the temple interview anyway, so...
Yeah, the point was made that people can lie anyway, so why try to exercise the control? Bingo.
Do you want to moderate this? I'm doing it.
This is a most beautiful and eloquent comment from a person who joined the church from Catholicism, discouraged by the dominance of that system and loss of agency, enhanced by the vision that in Mormonism there would be agency, only to find that at every level conceivable, this agency was deprived to herself and to the children, at the most mundane, simplistic levels, and at the most profound and fundamental levels. And the question that is being asked is, how can we, as a system, do things that will help people exercise agency and develop? And then we got the problem of women being lesser and treated as lesser. So how do women especially then develop agency, and what does the system do to help that agency develop? Is that the question? Okay. Now we got to go. I can't think of a better place to break. I think that's the fundamental question that we're leaving with. Now you want to have a shot at that as a okay, well, hang on. Now we're going to break because we got to break. But we'll and you and I can talk. And anybody who wants to stand around and talk, we'll talk. But we got to be at least a little bit compulsive here and let people go. Thank you. It's been fun talking, and let's carry on here.